Chapter 44. The night became electric with gunfire. It seemed to be coming from every direction, from places it couldn't possibly be coming. Without a single conscious thought, I threw myself on top of the old man. I would take whatever bullet came next before I allowed him to be shot again. I landed pretty hard. I raised my head and swung my gun around in an arc trying to find Chasse Lamontagne, but he had disappeared. My thought was that he ducked down into the water behind his Grand Laker or possibly even Egan's boat. Then came a cry from the bridge above.
"I'm hit, Dad!"
Charlie groaned in my ear. "Get off me, you damn fool!" I realized that his body, under the ill-fitting coveralls, felt as hard as a suit of armor.
"You're okay?"
"I'll be better if you let me breathe." I rolled onto my backside and held my sidearm in a two-handed grip, trying to find a target in the water. Egan lay on the ground, his knees drawn up to his chest like a pill bug rolled up on itself. Charlie's leathery face was contorted with pain. I wasn't sure if it was from the rifle shot or how hard I had landed on him. From my seat in the sand, I could see Egan's Grumman drifting downstream. In the confusion, Chasse must have pulled the boat off the sandbar. He wanted to deprive us of a means of escape or pursuit. He had to be hiding in the water now behind his Grand Laker. I could have started firing at it. The cedar planks wouldn't have stopped the 16 hollow-point bullets in my Beretta, although I would have preferred jacketed rounds, but I wasn't as blasé about murdering a man as Lamontagne had accused me of being.
"I know where you are, Chasse," I said.
Another burst of gunshots, suppressing fire in the language of the military. When I dared raise my head again, I saw that the Grand Laker had also come unmoored. It was moving away in the river, pinwheeling in the current. As it drifted farther from the island and the glow of the campfire, I saw Chasse pulling himself up from the water over one of the gunwales. I fired three shots. One of them must have struck because he fell backward out of the boat before he could gain his balance. He was at the mercy of the water now. He wasn't wearing a life vest. His gun belt weighed somewhere between 15 and 20 pounds. His body armor, assuming he was carrying the full complement of steel core plates, might have weighed 40 pounds. He was a strong man, but not stronger than the river. Charlie worked his shoulder in a rotation, but the movement only made him wince.
"Where's Lamontagne?"
"In the river. I think I might have winged him. He's going to drown, Charlie."
"Where's Egan's boat?"
"Gone," I said. "But there's one left." Charlie could have let Chasse Lamontagne die just by hesitating. Instead, he sprang to his feet like a man half his age.
"Let's go!"
We trotted back up the spine of the island.
"I had figured out he was smarter than he pretended to be," said the pilot behind me. "I should have realized he'd set his son up as a sniper, the same as I did with Nick."
So it was Nick Francis up there on the ruined bridge or wherever he'd made his nest who had saved us from being picked off by C.J. Lamontagne. I found the canoe in the light of my headlamp.
"That's not much of a watercraft," said Charlie.
"And there's only one paddle."
"Better let me take it then."
There was no argument. As old and injured as he was, Charlie Stevens was one of the best boatmen I had ever known. I had seen him pole a canoe up Class 3 Rapids, a feat I had believed impossible until he accomplished it. I'd barely taken my seat in the bow before I lurched forward. Charlie, running, pushed the boat along the sand. I heard the splashes of his boots and then the forward shove as the keel scraped free of the gravel and floated into the current. There was barely a wobble as the injured old man leaped into the stern. He rarely sat in a canoe, preferring to stand if he was poling, or kneel like the Penobscots and Passamaquoddy did in their slender birch bark creations. Kneeling was an ancient way of paddling, and there was something holy about it beyond the churchly posture. It was how you demonstrated humility before the power of the river. I fired up my headlamp. As we drifted past the south end of the island, I turned my illuminated gaze on the dying fire. Egan was wriggling around on the sand. I wished I'd thought to cut him free.
"You all right there, John?"
I asked with real concern.
"Fuck you!"
was his reply.
As the bowman, it was my job to shout out the obstacles ahead and spotlight the water for signs of Chasse-la-Montagne. I focused on the nearly phosphorescent froth. Running water appears dark above channels in certain eddies, but bubbles white where it gains speed in the narrows. Follow the waves and shoot the V's between the rocks and you should be fine. Steer even a little off course and you might crash against a boulder and flip over. If you're particularly unlucky, you might find yourself held beneath the surface by the hydraulics of a falls, doing endless somersaults. Or you might be pinned between the overturned canoe and a rock by the force of the river until your crushed lungs fill with water. I saw no personal flotation devices in the canoe, a violation I used to cite paddlers for every day when I was a patrol warden. We'd be in the same tough spot as Chasse if we spilled in the rapids. Spray tasting of wet moss exploded in my face. I kept watch for the missing boats. Even before we came to the serious whitewater, the river had already begun to step down. I experienced the sensation of descending, the top half of my body tipping forward. The current guided us through the first of the real rapids and sucked us forward and faster into a white expanse of waves.
"On your left," Charlie said.
I swung the light around, but not before the hull knocked against the submerged part of a boulder I had missed seeing. The impact might have been enough to turn us broadside if not for Charlie's expertise. Somehow he made a series of strokes that centered us once more in the white water. I wished I had a paddle to help him. It wasn't just that we needed speed to find Chasse before an eddy sucked him under. Navigating the stepped falls without spilling required us to keep pace with the current. I never even heard the crash. But all at once we were upon the wrecked boat. The unmanned Grand Laker had failed to navigate two boulders, Scylla and Charybdis, in miniature. The bow had gotten stuck, wedged between the rocks, while the hydrodynamics of the river had lifted the stern clean out of the water. Within seconds, the front had swamped, and now the upended boat loomed ahead of us, on the verge of breaking apart. Of Chasse, there was no sign at all. To our immediate right was a ledge. Behind it was a protected eddy. Charlie spun our canoe around into the calm water with a grace that seemed effortless.
"Do you see him?" I called above the thundering falls. "Get out!"
"What?"
He gestured with his paddle at the boulder as we turned alongside it. I reached out with both hands and did my best to keep my center of gravity low to avoid upsetting the canoe. The next thing I knew, I was hanging from the rock with my legs dangling in the water. The surface was slick in places. I nearly lost my handhold as I began to climb. And my waterlogged boots were all but useless when I tried to involve them in my ascent. I stood atop the ledge, squinting downstream. I saw something pale, a hand perhaps. I shouted down at Charlie, still holding his position in the eddy.
"I think I see him! Run to shore!"
"What?"
The ledge ended 10 feet to my right. Beyond lay another smaller ledge, then a clump of bushes overhanging a dark, still stretch of stream. We'd cut across the river as we'd descended, and this was the far bank.
"I'll meet you below," the old man said.
I crept forward to the edge of the ledge and found myself facing a gap of at least 5 feet. Under normal conditions, it would have been an easy jump. But in the dark, leaping from a slippery bit of stone, with the landing place likely to be just as slick, I had no choice but to throw myself across the divide and hope for the best. The opposite ledge was as mossy and as treacherous as I had feared. I fell hard, but not into the water. The next leap was even farther, easily 10 feet, which meant I would be swimming, carried by the current, while I tried to grab hold of one of the frail alder branches overhanging the river. Without pausing to remove my boots, I dove in. The impact pulled the headlamp off my head. I came up spitting, already 20 feet down the river from where I'd gone under, and not at all close to the shore. I kicked and crawled and continued to drift, seemingly making no progress. Then I saw a branch protruding from the water. I lunged and grabbed hold of it. and my momentum swung me around until I was floating on my back, facing my boots downstream. The dead tree had toppled from the shore when its roots had been eroded. It had lost most of its branches, but I was able to use the snags that remained to pull myself along until I was looking up a leafy willow. Soon I was clawing through the waterside pucker brush, reopening cuts on my hands and skinning my shins on hidden logs. The wind was up, and the sky was clearing fast. Hundreds of stars had come into focus. I caught a glimpse of the Milky Way. Eventually, I broke free of the brush and found myself standing on an almost impossibly beautiful sandbar. Over the eons, the river had twisted and turned like a restless sleeper in its bed. I stood upon a low ridge and scanned downstream only to realize that my journey to shore had carried me past the place where I'd spotted Shas's hand. Just below the rapids where the Grand Laker had wrecked was another bar of gravel, almost an island, complete with a grassy crest and even a few wildflowers glowing white in the starlight. The river below was rippled but unbroken by obvious rocks. If Shas had just made it through the last stretch, he might have washed up alive on this bar amid the orchids. But there was no sign of him, nor of Charlie. I waded out as far as I could, then plunged into the river again, using the lee of the island to avoid being caught in the current. I walked the length of the bar, following its weedy crest, my boots so full of water they squished. My movements startled a sleeping snake. It was dark, the length of my arm. I watched it take off across the surface of the water in a series of S-shaped motions. A northern water snake, native to this land.
Mike!
I looked up and saw Charlie making his way toward me in my borrowed canoe. The sky had become luminous with constellations. My eyes had adjusted to the night. But my vision was anything but sharp. It took me a moment to realize that the old man had Shas LaMontagne in the boat with him. The tall warden lay awkwardly, unmoving, across the thwarts and the center seat.
Is he alive?
Yes. Had a heck of a time pulling him aboard, though.
The son of a bitch weighs as much as a moose calf.
Chapter 45. We laid Shas out on his side along the sandbar. The water had leached the color from his skin. His fingers were icicles. Because he was still breathing, albeit shallowly, we didn't administer CPR. We stabilized his neck in case he'd sustained a spinal injury in the rapids. I found 3 burn holes in the fabric of his uniform, a tight cluster over his heart. Every bullet I had fired had struck him and bounced off the armored plates. If I lived long enough, I might someday become a decent shot. Then we waited. Like a man with an itch, Charlie tried unsuccessfully to reach for the one spot on his back his fingers couldn't touch. I turned him around and found the hole in his coveralls where the bullet had pierced the fabric. The projectile had flattened itself against the combat vest Charlie had been wearing, concealed beneath his mechanic's disguise.
"Which letter did he hit?" he asked.
It took a moment for me to understand that he was referring to the reflective words on his back.
"The L in Al's?"
"He was a true marksman then, Shas's boy. I guess I'm lucky he didn't go for a headshot. But few gunmen can resist an easy target when it's offered."
The flag newly sewn on the chest and the slogan on the back of the coveralls made sense now. Charlie had chosen the outlandish outfit to give a shooter something to aim at. While I watched, my friend slipped off his monkey suit to remove the armor he'd been wearing underneath. The steel carapace must have weighed 100 pounds, but it had saved his life.
"CJ called out that he'd been hit," I said. "I told Nick not to hurt him bad if he could avoid it. That's better than he deserves for what he did to the Bouchard girl."
We'd landed on the south shore of the St. John. Above us, a steep hillside, nearly a bushy cliff, rose to Route 161,
the lone road from Allagash to Fort Kent. It must have been Nick Francis who'd called in the gunfight on his CB. The first officers to arrive were Chief Plord and one of his men from Fort Kent, followed by EMTs, sheriff's deputies, and Border Patrol agents outfitted in tactical gear and carrying Colt M4 carbines. The feds even sent a helicopter with a floodlight brighter than the noonday sun. The last of the principals to arrive was Detective Xanadakis, who wore a suit but no tie and without any product in his hair. I had never seen him so casually dressed. Then again, it was the middle of the night.
"What happened to Egan?" the detective asked.
"Hopefully he hasn't rolled himself into the river by now."
Xanadakis frowned. I explained that we had left him tied up on Musket Island. The detective left to confer with his troopers. Charlie was sitting on a log, chewing on a hunk of jerky and drinking from a canvas-covered canteen.
"There's a lot about what you've been doing in the valley that you need to explain," I said, "and not just to me."
"There'll be time for that.
You beat John Smith to a pulp." My intonation was almost that of a question. I was still hopeful I might be wrong. Instead, Charlie turned ornery.
"I don't suppose he mentioned that he maced me first. I hadn't even raised my voice and he sprayed me in the eyes. The next thing I knew, I was half blind and he was raining punches down on me. But no one taught the man to box. I defended myself."
A prosecutor might argue that he had defended himself with excessive enthusiasm, but Smith had fired a bullet at me, and I found it hard to fault my friend for cleaning his clock. I was more concerned about the fallout from his subsequent actions.
"You kidnapped Egan. That's a felony.
I took a risk and am willing to live with the consequences.
What will happen to Aura if you go to prison?"
The grim prospect made him fall silent.
"I could be charged as an accessory," I added.
"You tried to get me to let him go. You're in the clear."
"You're not worried?"
"Worries for people who think blowing on the dice will change their luck."
I never even heard Nick Francis coming. He wasn't there, and then he was. Most of my adult life, I had dismissed the romantic notion of Native Americans being able to move silently as a kind of reverse racism. But the fact remained that I was hyper-alert, still pumped on adrenaline, and yet Nick Francis got past my personal perimeter without setting off any alarms. The old Passamaquoddy wasn't wearing hunting camouflage or the pixelated pattern of greens and browns favored by the armed forces. He had no need of it, clearly. He was dressed from head to foot in denim, a Western leisure suit. On a sling over his shoulder was the lever-action Winchester 94 rifle he had used to ambush C.J. LaMontagne. He'd done his shooting in the dark without a night vision scope, using only iron sights. I was glad not to have the man as my enemy. Charlie had noticed how I'd jumped when his old friend appeared.
"Nick's a stealthy son of a bitch, but it's not on account of him being a native."
"I've just learned to be quiet around white people," said the former Passamaquoddy chief. "You folks are too unpredictable."
"Thanks for taking care of CJ," Charlie offered his jerky to Nick, who bit off a chunk.
"Stupid kid," he said, chewing.
"Murderous kid," I added.
Charlie picked a piece of meat from between his teeth with a fingernail.
"Where'd you shoot him anyway, Nick?"
"In the ass. It seemed the appropriate spot."
Seeing the two old men joking together made me think of Wheelwright and Fixico again. How many losses are greater than the loss of a good friend? Nick explained that C.J. LaMontagne had made a sniper's nest for himself atop the broken bridge. He had come equipped for the ambush with a 30-06 Browning, outfitted with a night vision scope that showed heat signatures. And yet, he'd still managed to miss seeing the septuagenarian native crouched calmly in the bushes nearby. CJ wasn't the only one feeling ambushed.
"So you've been spying on me since Holton?" I said.
"Keeping tabs," said Nick.
"We took turns," said Charlie. "I was flying by the seat of my pants,
I realized no one up here would talk to me, even with this brilliant disguise. He ran a hand over his shaved head. I knew word would get out who I really was eventually. People in the valley remember what happened in St. Ignace and what I did to Pierre Michaud. The only way I was going to get information from certain parties was through a surrogate. I turned to Nick. Which was why you sent me to see Kellum.
Don't blame me, the Passamaquoddy said, lighting a cigarette. I'm not the Lone Ranger in this scenario, or any scenarios.
They're going to keep us here all night answering questions, I said. Nick exhaled smoke.
You have some place to be?
As a matter of fact, yes. A person I care about is in the hospital, and I have been stuck up here instead of doing what I should have done and gone to see her. Charlie rose to his feet, looked me straight in the eyes, and rested one of his oversized hands on my shoulder.
Danny?
The last I heard, her temperature was through the roof.
I'm sorry, he said.
The Border Patrol can patch you through if you can't get a signal.
Good idea.
The Fort Kent Fire Department had lowered ropes for the first responders to use climbing up and down the incline. I refused the offer of being pulled up and made my way under my own power to the road above.
Between the rollover and the river, my body felt as if it had been pounded between a mortar and a pestle.
I caught sight of Xanadakis standing outside an ambulance, talking to someone seated in the back. It had to be Shas. The disgraced warden had revived quickly under our care. I was too far away to overhear the conversation, but the detective seemed barely able to contain his rage. Another ambulance had already taken the son to the hospital for emergency ass surgery. I glanced around for a familiar face among the Border Patrol guys. My phone showed no bars. The feds always got the best toys, including satellite phones for isolated backwaters like this one. Then I saw the imposing form of Stanley Kellum making his way through the scrum. His shoulders were hunched, his hands dug in the pockets of his Gore-Tex jacket. Despite the fact that he had given up his badge years earlier, not a single law enforcement officer stopped him. The aura of command surrounding the man was that overpowering. When he caught sight of me, he came to an abrupt halt. We stared at each other through the kaleidoscope of emergency vehicle lights. I remembered Venice's warning. Instinctively, my right hand fell to my side where I had holstered my Beretta.
Kellum!
The lieutenant started forward again. I realized where he was going. There were cruisers of various kinds now between Kellum and me. Huge metal obstacles with groups of men between them, gabbing as cops do at scenes where there are too many of them assembled and not enough tasks to go around.
Hey, Kellum!
Two Border Patrol trucks were parked nose to tail, with less than a foot separating them. I stepped onto the bumper of one of the Tahoes, heard its driver shout an obscenity, then threw myself forward. Kellum had reached the ambulance. Xanadakis had become aware of him. The detective turned toward the former warden with a questioning look on his face.
Detective, stop him!
Xanadakis heard my voice, but didn't catch my meaning. He stepped clear of the open doors, and I caught a glimpse of Shas LaMontagne gazing out of the brightly lighted ambulance, handcuffed and with a blanket around his broad shoulders. The officers nearby must have thought me a madman. I threw myself at Stanley Kellum as he leaned inside the ambulance, pulling the Heckler & Koch pistol from his jacket. It was a point-blank shot with a .45 caliber bullet. There was only one reason it missed. The second Kellum's finger curled around the trigger, I slammed his forehead against the doorframe. His hand jerked, and the pistol fired into a defibrillator. The hollow point exploded the glass monitor. By now, I had one hand on Kellum's thick wrist, trying to keep him from regaining his aim, while I snaked my other arm around his throat. I pulled with all my strength. The second shot passed over LaMontagne's bent shoulders and careened off something metal. The detective, having regained his wits, stomped on Kellum's Achilles tendon. The lieutenant staggered as I tightened my arm around his throat, but I wasn't in position to choke the breath out of him or cut the supply of blood flowing to his brain. The big old man kept fighting.
Xanadakis delivered a punch to the back of Kellum's thigh to the nerve bundle between his hamstrings. The lieutenant should have crumpled, but he only dropped to one knee. He fired a third shot, this time into the air. In the end, it took 5 officers to disarm Stanley Kellum and bring him to the ground. I was pinned atop him by the weight of bodies. One bonehead even punched me in the kidney by mistake. The cops, local and federal, finally succeeded in cuffing the retired warden and standing him upright. His face was coated with mud from the roadside. He glared with blazing eyes out of the brown mask, his anger directed now at a single person, me.
"Why?" he demanded.
"Because Shas didn't kill Pellerin," I said.
"It doesn't matter."
Stan Kellum had heard the call go out over the police radio. He had sped here to exact vengeance for his dead investigator. It never occurred to him that the person he really wanted to punish was himself. Chapter 46. The Border Patrol patched me through on a sat phone to Danny's hospital room, where my call was answered by her mother. Nicole Tate was a widow whose husband, a laid-off mill worker, had died before his 50th birthday. She was a hairdresser and cosmetologist by trade, and one of the great sadnesses of her life was that her daughter had turned out to be a tomboy who didn't own a single tube of lipstick.
"How is she?" I asked.
"Asleep." Nicole was a kind woman by nature, but made no effort to hide her frustration with me.
"Her temperature is down.
She doesn't remember how she got here, and doesn't understand how sick she is.
She keeps telling everyone she wants to go home."
"Have they figured out what's wrong?"
"Encephalitis."
The word might as well have stabbed me in the eardrum.
"What?"
"They think it might have been from the tick that bit her."
"Danny has the Powassan virus?"
Encephalitis was one of the diagnostic symptoms.
"They're not sure."
The disease was rare and often fatal, and many of the survivors suffered permanent neurological damage. Now it was my turn to gasp for breath. I had been in Florida for a full week, where half a dozen new tropical diseases, from yellow fever to West Nile virus, were sending people to hospitals and graveyards. And yet I had emerged from the Everglades with mosquito bites that had already stopped itching. Meanwhile, in Maine, a state everyone assumed was safe from such insect-borne plagues, my girlfriend had seemingly contracted a rare illness that might yet kill her after a single tick bite. The situation was simultaneously ironic and terrifying. What made it worse was the likelihood that Danny's case was a harbinger of American life as we would experience it in the coming decades, with death's emissaries breeding in every backyard birdbath and in every unmown plot of grass, if she even lived to see that dystopic future. That disquieting sensation of not having escaped the swamps of South Florida returned. I felt nauseous, but the sickness might have been as much out of guilt and fear for Danny.
"I am so sorry for not being there, Nicole." "She wouldn't have known if you were."
"Well, maybe she would have. She was delirious when I got here and thought one of the nurses, a young man, was you. She was mad at him. She said she knew he cheated on her. She was delirious, like I said. It didn't mean anything."
"Like hell it didn't."
"I'm headed back in the morning. I'll catch a plane first thing."
"Did you find your friend at least?"
"Yes. I hope it was worth it." Afterward, I caught a ride with Chief Plourd to my scout on the far side of the river. During the drive, he regaled me with the culture and tragic history of the Acadians in the St. John Valley.
"We are a displaced people," he told me.
Plourd might have made a good tour guide if my thoughts weren't so haunted. I wondered if anyone had contacted the warden colonel yet with the news about Shas LaMontagne and Stanley Kellum. The duty was mine by all rights, but I found myself hoping that someone else had reached him first. Tim Malcolm would be livid. Knowing the man's sense of honor, I imagined that he would feel it necessary to resign over the inevitable scandal. He had stayed too long in the colonel's job anyway, and it had eroded some of his better qualities. I didn't envy the man who succeeded him. The main press would rake the warden service over the coals for what our two officers, Lamontagne and Kellum, had done. Maybe Shoss was right. This valley had never been a good place for game wardens. Borders are always places of temptations. Drawing a line creates an open invitation for people to cross it. Not just men like the Michauds, but Charlie, too. I found myself impressed by his courage and ingenuity. Everything he'd done had been for Scott Pellerin. But I was disappointed in him as well. In an odd way, he had paid me a compliment. He had respected my abilities to do what he lacked the capacity to accomplish himself. My love for the old man was close to unconditional. But this day signaled the end of my apprenticeship. I had no doubt that Charlie Stevens would continue to teach me life lessons, but only small boys and fools worship other men. The point of life is to find heroism in yourself. Plord dropped me at my truck. The police were still mopping up the crime scene when I returned. Too much had happened that needed to be recorded and collected. A trooper directing traffic told me that the Attorney General himself was flying to Fort Kent to be debriefed. No doubt Colonel Malcolm would be accompanying him. For once, I was glad not to have cell service. I found Charlie and Nick again by searching for the silver Jeep. They were seated side by side on a guardrail, waiting to be interviewed by Xanadakis. Nick held a cigarette pinched between his fingers. "How's Danny?" Charlie asked. "That tick virus is the real deal." "How did you..." "I just got off the phone with Aura, who spoke with Kathy. You must have been worried sick." "Not as worried as I should have been." When a mosquito circled my head, I caught it in midair and gave it a squeeze. I opened my palm, but found that it was too late. The insect had already drawn blood. "Aura and I often say we're ashamed of the overheated world we're leaving our grandchildren." "You're no more responsible for the dismal state of affairs than anyone else."
"No less responsible, neither."
"You're never going to be able to make this up to Aura, you know. The fear you put her through the past few days. You'll need to clean out an entire flower shop." "She's forgiven me for worse," he said, meaning the crash that had left her paralyzed.
"But you're right that I have a lot to atone for."
"I need to catch a plane as soon as possible."
"Of course, but Xanadakis will need to interview us first."
"Do we have a story we're sticking to?"
"The truth?"
"Which truth?" He showed me that jack-o'-lantern grin.
"That's always the question, isn't it?"
"I'm sure we can get going by mid-morning at the latest, hopefully soon." "I don't suppose you have a buddy with a plane willing to give me a ride down to Portland."
"As a matter of fact, I do."
Then he rested a hand on my shoulder. Sometimes I forget the simple power of human touch to soothe one's anguish. After our interviews, Nick Francis drove Charlie and me to the grass airstrip outside Fort Kent. I had left my scout in the care of Plord. The chief said his nephew was a prodigy when it came to auto body repairs. I would find my véhicule better than new when I returned to Fort Kent, Plord proclaimed with characteristic grandiosity. I didn't dare hope. Nick pulled to a stop outside the single hangar and long strip of grass that comprised the Fort Kent airport. An orange sock was filled with a cool breeze streaming to the rescue from Canada. The sky was crisp and blue, with only a few sheep-like clouds bouncing along. I'd turned off my phone before I'd gotten service again. My superiors could wait for my attention until I'd seen Danny. Nick, however, had calls to make, something about his jailed son. He remained in the Jeep while Charlie and I unloaded the gear we would be taking back home with us. I had waited for a private moment to discuss the events of the past days with him. Friend or not, he owed me a reckoning. "That letter you left me,"
You must have suspected Shast from the start. He was the patient man you warned me about.
Yes and no, Charlie said.
He looked more himself, dressed in green dickies and a green tee. He was a wiry man whose forearm muscles still showed when he lifted the bags. The truth is, I didn't know what to think when I saw that badge on Smith's table. I'd always assumed it had been buried, burned, with Scott's body. I couldn't believe my eyes at first. In your letter you said you'd been duped. If someone had the badge all this time, it meant everything I thought I knew about this case was wrong. I started to turn it over in my mind again, wondering who I'd misjudged. There was Roland, of course, still running wild, and Egan, I learned, was out of prison. Even Kellum has always been such a prickly pear. I was sure he had kept information from me. But it was to Shas, yes, that my suspicions first went. It just seemed so unthinkable, though, given his sterling character. He would have had to have been a master manipulator. He's a hell of an actor, I said. I'll give him that much. I still don't believe he failed to recognize Scott when they crossed paths at the Valley View. He might be telling the truth about that, said Charlie. There was something odd about Scott. He had a quality about him. He could seem like just another face in the crowd. Sometimes I can't fully recall his features, and my memory isn't that full of holes yet. The sound of a plane passing overhead made us look up, but it was just the Border Patrol on another aerial reconnaissance mission.
I think what happened, said Charlie, is that Kellum sent Scott here incognito.
Probably he told the warden who'd hired Shas as his deputy, but the information hadn't gone further than that. So the first time LaMontagne even learned there was an undercover investigator in the area was when Pierre confronted him with the screw-up. Keep in mind that this all began with Shas's ambition. He became a deputy warden with an arrangement already in place with the Michauds. But even with the money he was getting from Pierre, he wanted more. He realized he could improve his clout and his financial situation if he could become a full-time officer. It was Shas who convinced the local warden to complain to Kellum about the valley being overrun with poachers, not realizing the lieutenant would send in an undercover operative without his knowledge. After Emmeline found the badge and Scott's cover was blown, Shas had a chance to tell the warden service. He could have saved Scott's life. But he was worried that the investigator had learned of his side deal with the Michauds. And so he stood aside as Pierre killed him. Shas's shoulder doesn't have a burn scar, by the way. But it does show signs of plastic surgery, Xanadakis told me. Shas's predicament, following the raid on St. Ignace, was that the Michauds could still turn on him and expose him as an accessory to murder. My theory is that he shepherded Pierre into that ambush. I think Shas was the one who suggested the escape route across Beau Lac. Why would Pierre have believed him? Desperation, Charlie said. Pierre couldn't be positive that someone in his gang wouldn't crack. He needed to get out of Dodge. Maybe he gambled that Shas wasn't smart or ruthless enough to turn on him. Pierre Michaud wouldn't be the last man to underestimate Shas LaMontagne. So let me get this straight, I said. Shas's plan was to go with you to Beau Lac and make sure Pierre died. Either he would shoot the fugitive or you would. If everything went like clockwork, he would eliminate the man who could link him to Pellerin's death and come out as a hero who took down a cop killer. Charlie nodded that big noggin of his. The one flaw in his scheme was that he assumed there would be a seat for him in my Super Cub. So instead of being the man who shot Pierre Michaud, it was you who got the glory. That's an empty word for it, but yes. People congratulated me for what happened, even though it meant we never learned what Pierre had done to Scott.
Emmeline had been kept in the dark about the details of the murder, I honestly believe. Michaud's sons refused to break, and I think Egan was terrified that if he revealed his part, he'd spend the rest of his life in a cell. Another tidbit I learned this week was that Egan suffered sexually during his first stint in the Maine State Prison, endured abuses I don't care to imagine. In the end, Chas got his promotion even if he didn't get a medal for shooting Pierre Michaud. He went on to have an undistinguished career, probably because he's been on the take the whole time from assorted lowlifes on both sides of the border. Pellerin's death was safely in the past until I came across Dupree's badge on John Smith's table. I glanced at Charlie with dismay.
You forgot it, back on the island.
Grinning, the old man reached into his pocket and produced the metal shield. I went back for it while you were disarming Stanley Kellum. Amazingly, this was the first time I'd seen Duke Dupree's badge up close. It was smaller than mine, but it felt oddly heavy in my hand. It seemed like a malevolent artifact. The badge had inspired young Pellerin to become the warden his grandfather never was and restore the family honor. And yet the same piece of metal had been Scott's undoing, too. It had given away his identity when Emmeline found it hidden in his motel room. Truth be told, I was glad to give it back. I wish you and Scott could have known each other. Charlie Stevens was not a man inclined to tears, but I could hear emotion in the sudden softness in his voice. He'd be 42 now, and maybe he could have taught you some things. You could have taught him too, more as likely. I understood that he had a story worth listening to, and so I stayed quiet. He showed me this badge second or third time we met, Charlie said. Told me about his grandfather's disgrace. Of course, I had heard all about Warden Duke Dupree, and there were some details I could have added to the tale, but I could see the young man needed to believe in his granddad's tragic fall. It wouldn't have helped to tell him what an ass Duke was. Scott carried the badge everywhere as a good luck charm. I warned him against bringing it undercover, but he laughed at me and said, "Charlie, you worry too much." After he went missing, I told the detectives to be on the lookout for it. I said it might be the most important clue they found to his whereabouts. But I figured Pierre wouldn't have risked its discovery. That's why I was so gobsmacked to see it on Smith's table in Machias. I felt that Providence had placed the badge before me and presented me with a second chance to do right by Scott. We all assumed that the truth of what had happened had died with Pierre. But if someone had the badge all this time, maybe they knew the whereabouts of Scott's remains, too. They might even have taken this thing off his body as a souvenir. The way I figured it, the only person who could have had this badge was one of the co-conspirators. They'd stayed quiet before, but not this time, by God. I am an old man, and what did I have to lose from leaning on them beyond the limits of what the law allows?
You could have lost your liberty, I said. You could have gone to prison.
I was so beset with anger, I wasn't thinking straight. I rushed up to confront Smith without even the ghost of a plan.
You saw how that turned out.
I saw it up close, I said. Afterward, I knew I needed help, someone calmer than me, so I asked Nick to be my second, so to speak. Not once in all the years we've known each other has that man let me down. The name Angie Bouchard connected us back to the Valley View. We hadn't heard Emmeline had passed. It seems we would have been better off following your lead and speaking with her daughter.
You didn't need to, I said. You only had to wait for me to show up.
We knew that Roland was there. I was watching the house while you met with Nick, and figured your appearance on the scene might flush him into doing something careless.
But when you left for Kellum's place, we had to make a decision. Nick followed Roland to Edmonston in my truck, and I followed you in his jeep. It ended up costing Angie her life. I feel like I have her blood on my hands, Charlie. If I hadn't knocked on her door... He squeezed my arm. You can't take responsibility for C.J. LaMontagne's evil act. Guilt is a temptation. It's understandable. But in this case, don't fall prey to self-reproof. It won't make you a better man, I can tell you from hard experience. The breeze blew puffs of the dandelions in the field, each seed a white parachute. I saw the shadow of a bird pass along the ground, and looking up spotted a raven riding the wind, silent and watchful. Those intelligent black birds didn't miss a thing. You used me, Charlie. You used me to flush out Roland, and then you used me to interrogate Kellum. He was watching the raven as it made another reconnaissance of us. I hope I have a chance to make amends for that. It was just that we knew that Stanley knew something more than he was telling, and there was no way he would share his information with me after our falling out. When you accuse a fellow warden of negligent homicide, by which I mean Scott's, he's unlikely to take you into his confidence again. As it turned out, Kellum wasn't keeping any dark secrets. My visit with him was a bust, looking back. Not so. You saved him from killing Shoss. Maybe that was another mistake. Take it from a POW. A quick death is a gift compared to life in prison. In C.J. LaMontagne's case, we're talking about a long time with nothing to think about except his bad decisions. And his father, too, is facing charges that might end up as a life sentence. Hopefully will. When did you begin to suspect Shoss? From the first. See, over the years, I had allowed myself to believe that I understood the whole story. The only mystery was Scott's final resting place. That's why seeing the badge shook me. I thought it was buried forever. But somehow it had gotten loose into the world and had ended up with this John Smith jackalope. How was that possible? The badge told me that I knew less than I'd thought. So I went back over everything again in my mind, and I remembered Shoss's suggestion we take a ride up to Bow Lack. With the advantage of hindsight, it occurred to me that Warden LaMontagne had been the only one who'd come out of the tragedy better off than before. But there was nothing to connect Shoss to Scott's murder, and I didn't want to get ahead of my evidence. Do you think Shoss sent his son to kill Angie? It's just possible he only wanted to find out what she suspected, and so he dispatched CJ to get the information. But the father should have known his son well enough to realize how violent he was. As long as he suffers for her death, I began to count off the charges that could be brought against Shoss LaMontagne on my fingers. Accessory to homicide, criminal conspiracy, multiple counts of attempted murder. Charlie reached out to close my hand. They're both going to pay, Mike. But not for Shoss's original crime. He's going to get away with being a party to Scott's murder. I wouldn't be so sure, my friend said with a hint of the old mischief. Roland is facing mandatory sentences on drug trafficking charges. He's likely to be more amenable to a plea than he was 15 years ago, especially when he learns it was Shoss who betrayed his father. Speaking of which, I found the waterlogged square of paper in my wallet. Pierre's bearded face had already begun to dissolve. I'm afraid your photo got wet. He pointed at a garbage can beside the fence. Throw it in the trash where it belongs. I have a question about the inscription on the back. The ink had run, but I was able to read the words to him. In battle, in the forest, at the precipice in the mountains, on the dark great sea, in the midst of javelins and arrows, in sleep, in confusion, in the depths of shame.
the good deeds a man has done before, defend him.
Oris says that's a quote from the Bhagavad Gita.
I got it out of a biography on Robert J. Oppenheimer, he said almost with embarrassment. The head of the Manhattan Project. It was a favorite verse of his. I figured the man who brought the atom bomb into the world knew more about shame and self-doubt than most people. The picture was so I would remember what I had done, and the quote was so I would forget.
A flock of black-capped chickadees landed in the bushes at the edge of the dirt parking lot. Among them was a bird who sounded as if he had a sore throat.
Hear that? Charlie said, whispering lest he scare them off.
There's a boreal chickadee in there with his black-capped cousins. You only get that species up north.
I know, Charlie. You taught me that a long time ago.
Right.
He coughed and looked at the grass beneath his boots.
Was it worth it? I asked.
Angie Bouchard dying? Kellum facing prosecution? Edouard Delhomme staring at deportation now that his protector is gone? Was it worth it for you to have closure?
He raised his eyes to meet mine.
You've never had a son, Mike.
Neither have you.
That's not true.
I have had two of them.
Someday, when you're a father yourself, you'll understand.
Chapter 47. When Stacy arrived in Charlie's plane, I wasn't sure if she was going to punch him or hug him. She did both. The punch was playful, but not light, delivered to the old man's sternum. It was the hug that caused him pain. He'd received a bruise in the back from the impact of C.J. LaMontagne's bullet against the steel plate in his body armor. It was a good thing his daughter didn't see the grimace when she tightened her arms around his torso.
You scared Mom and me half to death. Again, she said.
Charlie groaned in apology.
And your bald head.
She couldn't resist running a hand over her father's stubbled skull.
It's hideous.
We never knew what a master of disguise your dad was, I said. Stacy spun around at the sound of my voice.
And you!
I wasn't sure what treatment I was going to receive, but I prepared myself for the punch. Instead, she wrapped her arms around my waist and pressed her face against my neck so that I was looking down at the top of her head. Her thick brown hair smelled of the lavender shampoo I remembered having used in her shower.
Thank you, Mike, she said in a voice close to choking. Thank you for being here when he needed you.
I disengaged myself from her embrace.
He's done the same for me, I said, more times than I can count.
Nick and I had it all in hand, said Charlie, but we appreciated the young man's help.
Nick, hoping to head off an embrace, had lit another American Spirit as a diversion. He held out his free hand for Stacy to shake. She took it in both of hers. Nick Francis was clearly not a hugger.
I'm sorry to have brought you all the way up here from Florida, said Charlie.
Stacy lifted her aviator sunglasses and positioned them on top of her head. In the strong morning light, her eyes were the palest shade of jade.
Didn't Mike tell you? I'm applying for the position of Chief Warden Pilot. I heard the lead candidate was forced to drop out. Who better for the job than the daughter of the best man ever to hold it?
Stacy!
I hadn't seen Charlie look that excited in years, not since he'd learned his daughter and I were dating. She brought a hand to her mouth.
No, Dad!
What?
I was joking. Me? A game warden? That's nobody's idea of a good idea.
Besides which, the department fired me, remember?
Once more she turned her green gaze on me.
They don't need another troublemaker on the state payroll, not when they have Bowditch here.
I'd do my best, I said. Is it true about Wheelwright being eliminated from consideration?
Mom heard it directly from the colonel.
Maybe Major Pat Shorey had had a moral awakening.
More likely, others had persuaded him that hiring the hotshot pilot wasn't worth the risk to the service's reputation.
Stacy hugged her dad again. If it's any consolation, I'm thinking of sticking around for a while. Her father couldn't suppress his eagerness. How long? Indefinitely. She didn't look at me when she spoke the word. She seemed to make an effort to avoid doing so. But I felt as if she'd whispered it into my ears.
What about the Panthers? Charlie said.
It's going to take more than one woman to save them. None of us had asked for an explanation, but she must have been preparing her speech on the flight up. You know, I used to think I could win every battle if I fought hard enough. But Florida has made me realize how close I am to becoming a casualty of war. I guess I'm tired of fighting everything and everyone all the time. I hadn't had to think about Stacy while she was in Florida. No decisions were required of me. Her returning to Maine didn't need to affect my relationship with Danny. I made a vow to myself that it wouldn't.
How's Buster? I asked.
Stacy grinned. To be honest, I think his nose is going to be improved by the surgery. Her friend was bitten in the face by a python.
Let's hear the story, said Charlie. I'll tell it on the flight.
Stacy returned her aviators to the bridge of her nose. We have to get you home to Mom. She's been waiting long enough. You need to drop me in Portland first, I said.
What's in Portland?
Charlie leaned in close to his daughter and whispered something I couldn't hear. Danny was awake when I arrived at her hospital room. I was in need of a shave and a shower, but I had purchased a bouquet of red roses from the shop downstairs. She had tubes and wires attached to her arm, but she was sitting up in bed. Usually, she wore her shoulder-length hair in a ponytail, but now it was spread across the pillow. Her face looked like it would scorch my hand if I touched it. The television, mounted to the wall, was tuned to one of those Saturday bass fishing shows that I abhorred. Nicole was keeping vigil beside the bed, with a copy of Us Weekly magazine open on her lap. More Harry and Megan.
Hey, stranger,
Danny said as if I had just returned from a quick trip to the cafeteria.
Hay is for horses.
It was one of our jokes. I leaned down and kissed her on the forehead. The skin felt as hot as it looked.
You just missed Kathy, she said.
Her eyelids were heavy. Her throat sounded scratchy. Nicole Tate rose to her feet as if in indignation, but it was only to take the inadequate bouquet from me.
Kathy Frost has been here a lot, she said,
emphasizing the last word so the message was unmistakable. I leaned over the bed again and looked into Danny's tired gray eyes. I had expected to see fear in them, but I didn't. In her place, I would have been terrified.
You look good. There's someone whose brain was about to explode, you mean?
I'm sorry, Danny.
Why?
For not getting here sooner. I should have...
Yes,
said Nicole.
Mom, can you give us a few minutes?
They're going to be coming soon to take you for those scans, Danielle. She exerted herself to raise the arm with the IV from the mattress.
I'm not going anywhere.
After Nicole had left, still clutching my flowers, I knelt down on one knee beside the bed and took Danny's hand. The bed, on its wheels, was quite high, making the gesture feel all the more ridiculous. We couldn't even make proper eye contact. At least she smiled, revealing one of her secret dimples.
Get off your knee, Mike.
I don't have an excuse, but I have an explanation.
I don't want either of them. I know about what happened up there. Kathy told me.
That son of a bitch, La Montaigne.
People can be so evil it makes me sick.
I don't know how anyone can decide to bring children into this world as fucked up as it is. I let that one go. I understand if you're not ready to forgive me.
You were doing your job.
But I wasn't doing my job.
It was a personal thing. I could see her forcing her mind to focus.
You want to feel guilty.
I do feel guilty.
That wasn't a question.
Guilt is your go-to place. Always has been. Get over it.
Move in with me?
I said, reaching for her hand again. She rolled her eyes.
No.
I'm serious. I thought about it on the flight down here. Apply for a transfer to Troop D.
You apply for a transfer.
When I didn't respond, she said,
See? That's just it. I don't have a problem with your not being here. I have a problem with your not knowing what you want.
When I stood up, I felt stiff, sore, and lightheaded from lack of sleep. 31 was too young to be middle-aged, but it was too old to be having the conversation Danny and I were having.
Consider it at least, I said.
No.
Why not?
She was beginning to flush and perspire.
Because I have plans. They might all be shot to shit, but I've worked my ass off to get to where I am, and I won't stop now. Whatever the doctors say.
I had always admired her perseverance. She had the most grit of anyone I had known.
You're right. I'll put in for a transfer. I'd even be willing to go back to patrol.
I'm too tired for this conversation, Mike. You might think you're ready for happily ever after, but you aren't. Take care of your wolf first. See how that goes.
Two nurses arrived to wheel her to whatever imaging scanners they were going to use to map her brain. I hadn't detected a change in her mental process. If anything, I'd been taken aback by her lucidity. More than taken aback. Properly chastened. Danielle Tate had a constitution that made Rasputin look like a 90-pound weakling.
I'll be here when you get back, I said with artificial-sounding good cheer.
Feel free to change the channel. After they took her away, I dropped into the chair vacated by her mother and found it still warm with body heat. I let my bloodshot eyes rest on the television set. The host of the fishing show was a good old boy with an impressive tan. I watched him muscle a bass out from under a fallen cypress in a lake that looked a lot like Okeechobee.
Whoo, baby, this one's a swamp donkey. Look at her kick.
I hit the mute button on the remote. In the quiet, my mind drifted back to the Fort Kent airstrip before Stacy had arrived in the Cessna. Standing at the edge of the runway, Charlie had held out an arm to indicate a faint path, more like an accumulation of footprints in the grass crossing the landing strip. The prints led to a line of trees, lush and green in the morning sun.
Follow that trail a short ways, and there's a nice waterfall, the old man had said. Used to be a sure place to catch salmon and trout. Then the muskies got into the watershed, and they cleaned out most of the native fish. They're apex predators, muskellunges. They're here to stay, like it or not.
There's always someone bigger, someone hungrier, I had said.
What's that?
I was remembering my visit to Florida. Before I left, he told me, never trust a man without secrets.
What did you mean by that?
Are you still chewing on that chestnut?
He was back to being the folksy old woodsman I knew and loved.
Every human being has secrets. If a person doesn't seem to have any, it just means they're devious at covering them up. Your man Wheelwright, for example.
Not just him.
No,
he'd said, catching my meaning.
Not just Wheelwright.
Both of us had fallen silent then. Across the strip of grass, the dry wind gusting down from Canada blew ripples in the treetops like waves across a green sea. The humidity had broken, but it would return soon enough. It was only June, after all, with the hottest months ahead. Eventually, the Cessna appeared, no bigger than a fly in the southern sky. I hadn't been thinking about Stacy before I saw the plane.
hadn't been anticipating seeing her, hadn't felt excitement stirring inside me. Those were the lies I told myself.
This is Henry Leva. Thank you for listening to One Last Lie, a Macmillan Audio production from Minotaur Books. This program was produced by Katie Rubitsky, recorded by Howard Bernstein. Text copyright 2020 by Paul Dworin. Production copyright 2020 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.